Okay, never mind. Right, this is probably a first for many at a convention. Let me think here. Catch. Okay. Over there. Somewhere half down on this side, just behind Sam there, or somewhere. And one towards the back, because they'll probably never reach it, okay? Right. This is the speaker bribing the audience with sweets to stay awake. There is a point behind this. In Greystones, we have just had open Auntie Nellie's Traditional Irish Sweet Shop. A grandfather and grandchild's delight and a mother and father's nightmare. All those jars of traditional sweets you used to go into and buy by the quarter. The colours, the lighting and the glass, the clear plastic, just hits you as soon as you go through the door. It's an amazing shop. If you visit Greystones, you'll have to go in just to see it for the visual experience. It's literally eye candy. Well, the reason I've given these out, and please, you share them, you pass them along, okay? Adam Jones, right? The reason I'm giving these out is not just to keep you awake, because I was struck by something Tim Keller memorably said. You've heard of the meat of the word, and you've heard of the milk of the word. Well, when it comes to understanding the Proverbs, says Keller, Proverbs is the hard candy, the boiled sweets of the word. You need to let them rest on your tongue until you, over time, get the flavor and the goodness out of them. You don't swallow them whole. You let them do their work over time. And in this session, I want to look at a few of the other themes in the book of Proverbs, particularly in the area of relationships. And these are things that I think will hopefully give us a chance to mull them over, to let the proverb, let the word do its work as we see what's he saying here, what's he not saying, how does this affect my life. The first key relationship is actually the dominant one in the whole book, and that is the relationship within the home. The early chapters, we know, have this recurring theme, especially at the start, my son, my son, my son. The very first proverb in the selection of the Proverbs, chapter 10, verse 1, a wise son brings joy to his father, but a foolish son grief to his mother. It's a rearing proverb. The very final chapter of the book about the wife of great character is a passage about the home. Many others litter the book, often marking off sections. And for those who have studied this, I'm particularly indebted to Bruce Walke's commentary, very technical, but the service I think he's done for the church is he has sought to find structure and purpose in the direction of the book of Proverbs. It's very hard for those of us who aren't that acquainted with the Hebrew when you're dealing with such linguistically compact little verses. It's very helpful. I mean, some people have simply said what I sort of argued against earlier, and that is that the book is not structured, that it's messy. And somebody has once said, well, it's just messy because life's messy, and they're all just thrown in there. I don't actually believe that. I believe this was a syllabus for training a young man in the way he should go, and that there is a purpose behind it. So the parenting and the rearing proverbs often mark off dividers, starts of sections, ends of sections. As a parenting manual, Proverbs won't tell you how to deal with teenage curfews, or what to say when they don't want to come to church, or how to monitor their computer time. But it deals with the core issues of what values and priorities are you not only going to teach your children, but are you going to model for your children. When I went off to university as a naive 18-year-old, I remember sitting in the common area of my hall opening a package from home. I was sitting with a few friends, including a girl I had just met, and was probably quite keen to impress. So I opened the package, and in it was a new Bible. I'm glad to say, even though I had no idea what, if anything, this girl believed, I was cool with that. That wasn't an embarrassment to me at that age. I simply said, oh great, a new Bible. And I set it down and got on with opening the rest of the package. She picked up the Bible, and she opened it and flicked through it, and she opened it to the fly leaf and noticed that my mother had written something on the inside of that fly leaf. She started reading it aloud and said, oh, what's this verse here? It says, Proverbs. And I froze. I thought, oh no, my mother has stuck down something from chapter 7 warning me to resist the alluring charms of the adulterous woman and any chance I may ever remotely have had of this young lady's interest has just disappeared. But no, I think, fortunately, my mother had put in something instead from chapter 3, famous verses 5 and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him and He will make your paths straight. But to this day, I'm so grateful for parents who took the challenge of Proverbs seriously, who prayed over me while I was still in the womb, and who thought, though they would say it themselves imperfectly and haltingly, yet very humbly and effectively, to play the part of the spiritual guide and mentor that Proverbs encourages parents to be. In those verses in chapter 3, we see another interpretative key to the book. Earlier on, we talked about knowing yourself, knowing God, understanding the world, and through Proverbs 1 and 7, the fear of the Lord. Well, there's another key here in Proverbs 3, 5 and 6. It encourages us to have an undivided heart, to deal with what Augustine famously called our disordered loves. And the reason we're not wise is that our loves are out of sync. They're not focused on or centered or oriented towards our Lord, but instead they're given over to all sorts of idolatry. And early in the book, Solomon encourages his son to live by God's wisdom and in faith, to do so entirely, trust in the Lord with all your heart, to do so exclusively, don't lean on your own understanding, and to do so exhaustively in all of your ways. Acknowledge Him, and He will make your path straight. At the end of the day, is that your greatest hope, your greatest prayer for your kids? Parents, part of living wisely is being proud of your children for the right reasons. Getting joy from your children for the right reasons. Not because of their academic achievements or career prospects, but because they're honouring God and how they live. You see, there's a popular misconception about this proverb, and a similar one in Proverbs 16, verse 3, which says, commit to the Lord whatever you do, and your plans will succeed. Now, I used to think that Proverbs 3 and 6 and Proverbs 16 and 3 used to mean, you know, give your plans over to the Lord and you will be successful. What you do will work out for the best, but it's actually the other way round. It doesn't say in all your plans acknowledge Him or commit your plans unto the Lord. It says in all your ways commit to the Lord whatever you do and He will direct you. Your plans will succeed. What it's saying is not that you sort of bring God your plans and then you will succeed. What it's saying is that as you commit what you do to the Lord, as you live, as you act godly, then you become the type of person who makes smart choices, that makes smart plans. Your plans suddenly become more attuned to His plans. Your life actions are committed to Him, and your plans then become smarter. Is that what you want for your kids? To be the sort of kids who commit to God what they do so that their plans actually become His plans and they have the spiritual smarts. I sadly suspect that if I give some of the professing Christian mums and dads in many of the respectable upper middle class churches where I've preached, if I give them the choice, for example, between their daughters getting straight A's at school, getting first class honours degree, being an attractive size 8, marrying a successful lawyer and producing 4 perfect grandchildren, but turning their back on God and not really being involved in the Christian community at all. Or, on the other hand, having their daughter leave school early, struggling with weight issues, being unemployed or working in some very menial job, remaining single or marrying somebody who was unemployed, yet going on with the Lord and fully committed in their local church. And I said to them, which two of those do you want? I sadly suspect that some of them would not choose the right one. You see, the parents are to be the prime mentors. We have to have godly ambitions, godly priorities for our children. And the father and mother are to rear together. You see that throughout, that it is from the first chapter, listen, my son, to your father's instructions. Do not forsake your mother's teaching. You get that throughout the book and right through to the final chapter of the godly wife of noble character. They're in this together. They're singing off the same sheet. They believe they want the same thing for their children. Folks, don't delegate the spiritual rearing of your children to the church. It is your job as parents. And it is the church's job to help you and to guide you and to pray for you and to support you. But the church cannot rear your children. The second relationship that we deal with here is that of the friend. And I want to turn to chapter 27 for this, Proverbs chapter 27. And a series of Proverbs through this chapter that, again, one of the things you do is they may look unconnected, but if you can find a stream or a line or a theme, you begin to see how some of the other Proverbs fit into that. And we see here some of the things that threaten friendship, and then some of the characteristics of a true friend. Some of the things that threaten friendship, the first couple of verses, first of all, self-promotion and boasting. Friendship will be damaged, you know, by the sort of person who's always talking about themselves. An example of selfishness, who's only interested in them and not others. You know the sort of person that said that if they were made of chocolate, they would eat themselves. It was said of one of the people who did well in this country under the boom, that he was a self-made man who worshipped his creator. You know, the type of person, it only takes one of them to change a light bulb because the world revolves around them. The wise and godly person doesn't boast, because that is to set yourself up higher than you really are. Seeing yourself constantly in comparison with others. It's an example of a fool. James in the New Testament says, don't boast about tomorrow. Quote says, only God knows what tomorrow will bring. You're not God. There was a narcissistic husband whose ex-wife claimed that she divorced him for religious reasons. He thought he was God and she didn't. And it's that sort of self-promotion that can damage and is an example of folly. In the context of the theme here, we need to see that at the start, the editors of Proverbs are saying something very important about friendship in this chapter. Promotion, self-promotion, and narcissists are boring people. You will lose valuable friendships. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, love is not self-seeking, it's not proud, it's not puffed up. Elsewhere, he encourages Christ followers to consider others better than themselves. Friendship of real worth to other people is incompatible with boasting. It's also damaged by snideness or irritation, which is the meaning in verse 3 behind provocation. As somebody who's consistently irritating to other people lacks the self-awareness to be a good friend. As does somebody who's jealous or a hothead in verse 4. The proverb implies that jealousy is actually worse than a bad temper, because although a temper can be cruel and overwhelming and do damage, jealousy is more measured, it's more sinister, it's cancerous, it's corrupting, it eats away, it ruins your character bit by bit. It's not a flash in the pan. And many friendships have been ruined by jealousy. Straight and simple. Jealous of someone else's relationships or their success or their money or their relatively trouble-free life while you're struggling with problems. The person who allows themselves to become jealous disqualifies themselves from being a good and faithful friend. It really serves to isolate them even further, and they retreat into their bitterness. Love does not envy. If boasting puts ourselves in the place of God, jealousy puts something else in the place of God. We're jealous because the thing that someone else has, maybe status or success or money or sex appeal or love or achievement, is the thing that we ultimately want. And we can't imagine living without it. And it twists us. So these things are not just part of a list of sins. They're idolatry. that takes over our heart and our purpose in living. Other things through the chapter that damage friendship are unfaithfulness on the part of the husband, verse 8, the man who strays, or nagging and touchiness on part of the wife, verses 15 and 16. So what should be the closest friendship of all is ruined and marred by selfishness, by betrayal in one case, and by a pathological quarrelsome nature in the other. Instead of love and security and acceptance, there's secrecy and fault-finding, manipulation and control issues. Insincerity is also a curse on friendship. We saw this in the first session. I had a friend who regarded it as obscene to try to hold a conversation with him before 11 o'clock in the morning. He loved chapter 27, verse 14. If a man loudly blesses his neighbor in the morning, it will be taken as a curse. But it's not about being a morning or an evening person. It's about sincerity. The image here is of somebody who wants to be first on the scene with a pious blessing, going around parading it for everyone else to see. Always has to be important, always has to be there first. Using religious language, but not being there, the implication is, well, maybe they really need help. Jesus speaks about these people when he says, don't be like them. Don't be like the Pharisees who pray loudly on the corner of the streets to be seen by men. They have their reward now. Don't be guilty of insincerity. Even words of blessing, scriptural verses delivered insincerely, can rebound as a curse on the one who delivers them. The final blight on friendship that I want to highlight is verse 20. It reminds us that our eyes can never be satisfied. It's the greed. Nothing in this world will ever totally satisfy human appetites. No quantity of money, sex, or power, nothing material or experiential will fill that unique void in each of our lives to be the people we were created to be. So then, what are the positive sides? How can we be the friend that we're called to be? Well, it's shown, first of all, in verses 5 and 6 in authenticity, the opposite of the insincere. The difficult thing that is said, the rebuke graciously and lovingly given. Or in verse 10, availability. What really matters at some times of tragedy is not blood relationships, relatives may be far away, but a good neighbour who's a friend. And verse 17, a good friend encourages. Iron sharpens iron. Nothing better among friends than discussing together issues of great importance, sharpening one another's minds, rising above the small talk to engage with real issues. Friends stimulating one another's minds and keeping each other ready for battle to face the challenges of each day, just as soldiers would sharpen their weapons, iron on iron, building one another up, exhorting and encouraging one another to be strong in the Lord. It's why isolationism, it's why removing yourself from the Christian community and trying to going it alone is another example of sheer folly. Proverbs 18:24 reminds us that we have the need, all of us, for a friend who sticks closer than a brother. And as the New Testament shows us, and our Lord Jesus, that is realized. He no longer calls us servants, he says in John 15, I call you my friends. He sticks closer than the brother because he initiates us into a new family with new ties that are thicker even than the strongest ties this world can give us. He can even help us break those old family ties where they are unhealthy and dysfunctional and destructive and give us new brothers and sisters, together getting our identity from him, the friend of friends from which all other friendship takes their lead. The Proverbs deals with another group, various other relationships that I don't have time to go into this morning, how we deal with our neighbour, particularly how we deal with our poor neighbour. You see that coming together in 14 and 21. It is a sin to despise one's neighbour, but blessed is the one who's kind to the needy. Or bringing together wise speech and good neighbourliness, 25:18, like a club or a sword or a sharp arrow, is one who gives false testimony against the neighbour. So the speech damaging our relationship with our neighbour. Or 26 and 19, like a madman shooting deadly arrows, is one who deceives their neighbour and then says, I was only joking. This is a community book, so a lot of the application has relevance to being lived out in the wider community. And again, when we think of wisdom, we think often ourselves, don't we, of decisions I need to make for my future and my well-being and my success. I want to know what job to go into. I want to know who to marry so I can feel secure in that relationship. I want to know where to live. I want to know what the best standard of living is. But wisdom, again, the majority of application in this book is not about your future. It isn't about you, stupid. It's about how it affects other people in the wider community. Proverbs turns it on her head. Better to have nothing and serve others. Better to give to the poor than to accumulate wealth for yourself. There's also our relationship with our work. The sluggard or the idler is one of those fools that pops up throughout the book. Proverbs gives all work a dignity, no matter how menial. It's in line with the book of Genesis, where work precedes the fall. Work needs to be done well and loved and redeemed. Done for God's glory. Done for the benefit of others. Not done for the bottom line or for storing up treasures that have been gotten at the expense of others. Part of wise living is to ask in what way our work, our vocation, is serving others and glorifying God. But the second part of what I want to say this morning really has to do with how wisdom helps us in our reactions to certain circumstances and our response to things, good and bad, that life may throw at us. Look at chapter 4, verse 23, part of the prologue in the summary instructions or sermons that Solomon is giving to his son. Chapter 4, verses 23 to 27. Above all else, this comes halfway through, my son, pay attention to what I say. Above all else, guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life. Put away perversity from your mouth. Keep corrupt talk far from your lips. Let your eyes look straight ahead. Fix your gaze directly before you. Make level paths for your feet and take only ways that are firm. Do not swerve to the right or the left. Keep your foot from evil. Guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life. The heart is the source of our deep loves, our hopes, our desires that dictate what we think we need for successful life, successful marriage, successful work. And the reason we need to guard our hearts and curb our appetites is that if anything other than the fear of the Lord enters there, if any idol gains the upper hand, what we'll find is that the choices we then make will actually undermine the very thing we most desire. Look at what gets us angry. What are we defending? Ourselves? Our idols? See, what gets us angry the most gives an indication of what we love the most. Anger is usually negative in Proverbs, but we see from the context that, for example, in chapter 22, 24, it says, do not make friends with a hot-tempered person. Do not associate with one easily angered. The negativity is for anger without a cause. And just as though anger without a cause is a sin, so too, not being angry when there is a cause is also a sin. So we've got to guard our hearts. Are our loves disordered? What did I mean earlier when I said that if we get this wrong, if we replace the fear of the Lord with something else, then the choice we make will actually undermine the very thing we're looking for? Well, put it this way. Say becoming married is the most important thing in your life. Then what you'll find is that you will pursue that so single-mindedly and so unwisely that the choice that you make will actually undermine you ever having a fulfilling and godly marriage. You'll be full of ungodly expectations and you will seek to manipulate and control to hold on to that. If you feel that getting on in your career is the most important thing, then from the wellspring of your heart will come all sorts of inordinate desires whereby you stand in the way of others to get your way and actually stop yourself from becoming the type of professional or worker you're called to be. If being a good dad is the most important thing in your life, then you will break the hearts of your children and yourself. You will either be too disciplinarian because you want to control them, or you'll be too lenient because you can't bear for them to think badly of you. Fear of the Lord, wisdom, on the other hand, will keep our desires in proportion and perspective, and will enable us to have good, healthy, and godly relationships. The image in chapter 4, 25, 26, and 27 is of being kept on track, kept from wandering. Guard your heart. But the book also has a lot to say about our relationships with other great seducers, particularly wealth and power, or as I would extend it to include responsibility. Let's go to chapter 10 again, just for illustration on this. Here we see how we are to acquire wealth, how much it consumes us, and to what extent we rely on it. Perhaps the most obvious principle in terms of how we acquire it is that it's got to be in a godly way, because as verse 2 we saw earlier this morning, treasures can be gotten in an immoral or illegal way. Dishonesty, exploitation, corruption. In fact, it's of no eternal value, because the second half of the proverb usually explains the first, and the second half is about being delivered from death. So the idea is that ill-gotten treasures, wealth acquired badly, is of no eternal, it will not save from death. It is of no eternal value. In contrast, it's possible to attain wealth not only legitimately, but as a result of hard work and integrity. Verses 4 and 5. In contrast to the lazy, the diligent person earns wealth and avoids disgrace in the family. So a simple ethical principle of avoiding crime and laziness and embracing hard work and honesty. And if you add to that Proverbs' concern for the poor and the need to help the poor, then we can apply John Wesley's famous dictum, work as hard as you can to earn as much as you can, to give as much as you can. There's a second principle here concerned with wealth. It's the extent to which wealth and the search for wealth consumes us. Tony was dealing with that in a seminar, of course. Look at verse 3. The Lord does not let the righteous go hungry, but he thwarts the craving of the wicked. Many are sucked into an obsessiveness about money out of fear that they will not have enough. But verse 3 says, the Lord does not let the righteous go hungry. It prefigures Christ's words, don't worry about what you will wear or eat or drink. The Lord knows what you need. But the craving is that inordinate desire that takes over the soul. The third principle of wealth concerns the extent to which we rely on it. Verse 15 is an interesting one. The wealth of the rich is their fortified city, but poverty is the ruin of the poor. Now, on the surface, this seems to be saying the wealth of the rich, that's where they have their security. It's positive. But no, there's a deep irony in the proverb. Because cities, even fortified cities, can be breached and can be overthrown. And there is no doubt that the rich maybe imagine their wealth to be burglar-proof, but the rest of Proverbs warns us against trusting in riches. You see, there's a difference here. The proverb doesn't say it is a fortified city. It says it is their fortified city. It's all they've got. And if you look at chapter 18 and verses 10 and 11, you get the fuller picture. Look at chapter 18, 10 and 11, verse 10. The name of the Lord is a fortified tower. The righteous run into it and are safe. Next verse, the wealth of the rich is their fortified city. Exactly the same as chapter 10, 15, first half. Second half different. They imagine it a wall too high to scale. So you've got the same phrase, but it's clearer. In contrast to verse 10, the name of the Lord is a strong tower. That's where our security lies. So material wealth is the security of many, but it's the security of the deluded person. The phrase in Proverbs, in your own eyes, is always an alarm bell that it's not really the way it is. If you're wise in your own eyes, it means you're not wise. There's a proverb in chapter 17, I think, that talks about a bribe being a magic charm in the eyes of those who give it. So they think that this is going to solve all their problems if they bribe their way to the top. It's not the reality. Poverty is to be avoided. It can ruin people, we see in chapter 10. It can drive them to despair or to crime, which is why perhaps the most profound words on this whole subject of wealth and poverty are from Agur in chapter 30. This unknown chap from perhaps even outside the Israelite community who has this amazing prayer. Two things I ask of you, chapter 30, verse 7. O Lord, do not refuse me, keep falsehood and lies from me, and give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. Otherwise I may have too much and disown you and say, who is the Lord? Or I may become poor and steal, and so dishonor the name of my God. The godly person doesn't perversely rejoice in poverty, but nor does he trust in riches. Chapter 11, verse 28. It's not a trusting. Riches are fleeting and will fail. They cannot be relied upon. Whoever trusts in riches will fall, but the righteous will thrive like a green leaf. The Lord is to be our security. Do not store up treasures on earth, where moth and rust corrupt. This next picture flashed around the world last year during the Australian floods. The caption said that the helicopter that took that photo as that family were being swept was not fitted with a winch. A tragic case, but a very accurate illustration of what I think it must feel like for those who rely on wealth. Eventually, sometime, they will find themselves swept along on this current that is too strong for them. And where is their wealth to help them? The wealth is like a helicopter without a winch. It's unable to save. In contrast, the Lord is the strong tower in whom we can take refuge. It is the person who has integrity in verse 9, who walks securely, chapter 10, verse 9. Wealth is to be acquired with integrity, but it is not to consume us or be relied upon to save us. And when all is said and done, what we've got about wealth, verse 16, at the end of the section in chapter 10, is that we must ensure that our wages, notice the economic word there, that our wages are life and not death. When it comes to the second thing, which is power, I want us to look at some verses from chapter 28. I extend this to refer to all sorts of responsibility. It's in the midst of several chapters dealing with ruling wisely, where true power and influence is to be found. And specifically, verses 12 to 18 talk about the essential nature of how a clear conscience before God is more important than earthly power. Verse 13 speaks of a different type of power, the power of knowing God's forgiveness. Or in verse 14, the freedom that is available when we tremble before the Lord rather than trembling under circumstances or other people or disaster or any of the multitude of other things that make us tremble. Blessed is the man who fears the Lord, but he who hardens his heart falls into trouble. Those who have hardened their consciences bring death and destruction to others, verse 15 and 16, like the roaring lion or the charging bear. But eventually, verse 17, guilt catches up with them, and they go to their graves hounded by the evil they have done. But those who are blameless receive the help of God. Those who lie in its dirt will be punished. From 19 to 24, we see that with wealth comes responsibility to be productive and generous. It warns us about the fantasist or the dreamer, verse 19. The get-rich-quick in verse 20. The bribe-taker in verse 21. The stingy in verse 22. The liar in verse 23. And those who sacrifice more important things for the sake of their own material benefit in 24. Who robs his father and mother and says, it is not wrong. And then the final section deals with a direct relationship between our relationship with God and our relationship with our neighbour. Greed brings about conflict. Self-centeredness brings insecurity. Hard-heartedness brings God displeasure, 25, 26, and 27. But on the positive, we can, verse 25, trust in the Lord. So what is the proof of where our gods are? The difference is shown in how, verse 27, we treat the poor, because they cannot give us anything back. Now, all of these proverbs seek to show that a person with responsibility or power that perhaps has amassed some riches, because money and power often go together, can bring great danger to themselves or their community if they forget their position before God. They seek to show the parent, the boss, anyone who has responsibility over others, how living wisely under God can transform their attitude to their family, to their workplace, and to the people that are around them. They show, as the first proverb in that section shows us, that our security will only be as strong as our righteousness before God. Chapter 28, verse 1. Otherwise we live like the wicked fleeing in a perpetual state of paranoia, even before invisible threats. I would summarize this chapter by saying, those who don't fear God live in fear. Those who have learned joyfully what it is truly to fear God can live without fear. Does that make sense? You've got those who fear the Lord can live without fear. But those who don't fear God flee though no one pursues. You don't fear the Lord, you actually ironically end up living in fear. The last section I want to look at is how we deal with adversity. Proverbs acknowledges that the wise person may suffer, and often the innocent will face adversity. Well, let's just go back a few chapters to 24. And here this might also be a little example of how you can perhaps look at Proverbs systematically. Again, I'm afraid the chapter divisions in our Bible are particularly unhelpful when you're dealing with Proverbs. But if you look at chapter 24 from verses 3 to verse 12, it might be helpful. Because what you have there is verse 3 starts with a house being built. It's the home. It's a proverb about the home. And if you look to verse 13, eat honey, my son, for it is good. So it's a new section, a my son section. So between 3 and 12 you have a unit, and it begins with the home, and I think the key proverb is verse 10, if you falter in times of trouble, how small is your strength. And that can be the interpretative key for some of the other proverbs that are gathered around that, because there can be an issue there in each of them that has to do with trouble, with distress, with adversity. Sometimes it's to do with warfare, conflict, victory, plots of evil, difficult political decisions at the gate of the city, whatever it is. I read an American blog a while ago where a well-known emergent leader says he only chooses to have faith in God because of the happiness it brings him now. That begs the question to me, well, what if he's having a bad day? So many of us are so bound to this world that only the here and now really matters. We're functional materialists. We haven't thought through what it means to be aliens and strangers, as Peter says, in the world. But these proverbs help us. It shows us, first of all, that at times of adversity we can have an anchor. The context in which we deal with that adversity is, again, the home. It's there in verse 3, by wisdom a house is built, through understanding it is established, through knowledge its rooms are filled with rare and beautiful treasures. The relationship the family has with God not only forms a firm foundation for home life, but it sustains it. It brings its own lasting rewards. Instead of being built around the dreams and ambitions of their own making, where the rewards are reduced to what our children achieve, etc., it reminds us that the production of godliness within the home is its own reward. Strength and trouble displays true power. Verse 5, the next couple of verses have to do with warfare. It's an unfortunate and unavoidable reality in a broken world, and as long as evil exists, countries will be at war. And as population increases, war increases. An important part of the godly leader at the time of Proverbs would have been to lead his people wisely, even in war. There would have been a time for war and a time for peace, a time for negotiation and a time for diplomacy. But in the Christian context, well, our battle is now with spiritual forces that Christ has already disarmed through his victory, but still wage war against us. What can we glean from this? What was true for the leader in Proverbs is true for us. To resist the warring forces of sin and Satan and temptation, we need verse 5 to prevail through great power. Not that might is right. The rest of the Proverbs and the Old Testament shows that it's not by power, not by might, but by my spirit. From Zechariah. So, the world has its wealth, but the wise person's wealth is elsewhere. The world has its security, but the godly person's security is elsewhere. So too, the world has its power and might, but the godly person has another power. They have a fixed and inviolable security that protects them, an inner vital energy that empowers them, the Spirit of God who guides them. So, all of keeping our eye on the eternal. And that is why this proverb lies in the context with the others, because it is in times of distress and trouble and difficulty that we learn the truth of that greater supernatural power. From experience, as we who seek to fear the Lord, we find that we are given an empowerment, a different power, a strengthened by a different strength. For Solomon and the other leaders of his day, it wasn't just strength that they needed to deal with opposition, they needed strategy. They needed each other. There was no point in having manpower if the soldiers were without leadership and fighting at cross purposes. So verse 6, you need guidance to wage war. Victory is won through many advisors. Strength in trouble comes from listening to wise advice. I was involved in a pastoral situation recently, and talking it over with a couple of colleagues, it was clear to me that the problem of the person was quite simply they wouldn't listen to any advice. They never had, and that is why their life was unraveling. Other people are part of the tools in God's armory for us, acting as our spiritual generals. It's not a case of listening to God or others. Discerning the voice of God in others is one of the marks of wisdom. Iron sharpens iron. There's a time for war, there's a time for peace, there's a time to be silent, and there's a time to speak. Verse 7. Wisdom is too high for fools, in the assembly they must not open their mouths. The wise are characterized by having strength. The fools are not fit to open their mouth in the place where judgments are given and advice is given. But the wise are those who have the qualities for leadership. Verse 7. They are the ones who should be entrusted with the decisions that affect people's lives. We know in this country all too well, don't we, the folly of having fools at the gate. People making decisions for the country based on greed and self-interest and cronyism. Proverbs could have told us that a long time ago. Godly wisdom is above the fool. They can't be entrusted with policy or justice. Similarly, verses 8 and 9 show how somebody who plots evil, who causes trouble and distress, will be recognized for what they are. They will be shunned by godly society. And then the final paragraph, verses 10 to 12. Strength in trouble is a true test of godly character. We are proved in terms of our character and what we live for, who our gods are. Not by how we are when things go well, but on how we do under stress. It's then when we're under attack that the metal, the true metal of a sports team is proved. It's at a time of war that a nation's character is tested. It's in time of trouble that the strength of the believer is seen. It's in the time of testing that our idols are exposed. If we react with bitterness and anger, we draw on our own resources because that's the natural way. But our idol is exposed. In verses 11 and 12, we are called to be lifesavers. Rescue those being led away to death. Hold back those staggering towards slaughter. The inference is that the danger may be inflicted on them. They're being led away by others to death. Or it could be self-inflicted. They're hell-bent, staggering towards their own destruction. Either way, we can't sit idly by and say, I did not see it. I never knew. God knows your heart. He knows if we have been motivated by self-interest or fear, if we're pretending. He's the ultimate judge. Wisdom, it says, builds the house. We can build on two foundations, sand or rock. Proverbs warns us, verse 12, about the one who wears the heart. How many times in his ministry does Jesus say, I know what is in your heart, knowing what they were thinking. Nathanael in John 1, the woman in John 4. He's the one on whom we must build our homes and our very lives. Because he is the one who ultimately did not falter in times of trouble. The one whose strength was proved in that he stood up to all that sin and death and hell could throw at him. And it is on that rock we stand. It is he who equips us to stand. He equips us to be the lifesavers of verse 11 and 12. Because he embarked on the supreme rescue mission. Rescuing us from the power of sin and the danger of being led away to death and destruction and lost forever. We do this. We rescue those being led away because he did it for us. There's an old 19th century gospel hymn that I used to hear my grandfather singing. Rescue the perishing, care for the dying. It has a verse that says this. Down in the human heart, crushed by the tempter, feelings lie buried that grace can restore. Touched by a loving heart, wakened by kindness, chords that were broken can vibrate once more. Rescue the perishing, care for the dying. Jesus is merciful, Jesus can save. That's what the church is all about. That's what we're called to be. Proverbs 24 isn't asking us to brave it out and do our best in times of trouble. It's calling us to the wisdom of God, revealed in Jesus. Build on that rock. Have his heart so that you won't be apathetic about our culture that's lost and spiritually bankrupt. But be challenged to take part in his rescue mission and let grace restore those broken cords in many lives. As we reflect on what God may have been saying to us, David's going to come in a moment and encourage us to pray over it. I'd like us to remain seated and sing a song, which I'm sure you'll know the tune. The words will be coming up. It's probably new for you, but at times then it talks about living a mentored life. It talks about having our passions purified. It talks about having an appetite and cultivating an appetite for God. It goes to this old Irish tune. Down by the Sally Gardens, you might know it as. Let's just remain seated and reflect.